We're going to fly through this because you guys obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, I don't want to presuppose that. I'm trusting that you're practicing what you preach. So let me just give you some practical things when it comes to giving as I counsel people, and particularly as it pertains to their offering. We talked earlier about your fixed monthly fees that you need to be aware of. Okay. 90% of people in our country, actually I think it's higher than that, are on a fixed income, meaning that they're on salary or they're on an hourly wage. So they know, in other than gifts or if they're, you know, buying stock options and making millions, most people know with a pretty good estimation what their income is going to be. And so as you're building your monthly obligations, very few people do it, but I recommend to people very strongly that they actually, and I know this sounds a little bit stale, but they actually treat their offering as a bill. And I know that doesn't sound very from the heartish, but I think you need to build that into your thought process. That given to the Lord is obviously you give from the joy, you give with joy. And with a heart of thankfulness and all the biblical fundamentals that we understand about giving. But what I know is this is true. If you wait till the end of your list to make that a priority, it will almost always fall off the priority list. In fact, I've got a slide, but I'm not going to show it to you. What do you think is the average percentage of AGI? You know what AGI is, adjusted gross income? Which is the number that you're actually taxed on. It's almost taxable income, but that's where they start taking your deductions from anyway. You know what the average percentage of charitable giving is as a percentage of AGI in America? It's about 2.4%. It's about 2.4%. Yeah, it's about 2.4%. So you need to understand on the constructs of our economics, if you're shooting for a 10% number, which you guys understand that tithing and 10% is, well, you understand that that's not a mandate, right? But it's a good rule of thumb. That's hard. In fact, I wrote it right here. Sacrificial giving is lifestyle limiting. For all believers, because of the economic constructs of our society, if you truly desire to give to the Lord and you're shooting for that 10% mark, you will, by definition, not have what your neighbors have. Okay? So just be prepared for that. It isn't a burden. It isn't, you know, it's not an anchor. But you need to understand that. If you're treating it as, well, I'm not a 10% guy, so what I do is at the end of the month, man, if I can give 15, I'll give 15. That guy's given 2. You understand what I'm saying? Well, I'm all about New Testament church ecclesiology, and I'm not a tither. I mean, I'm not a taxing system, right? Because that's what the tithing was. So I'm all about just give abundantly and from the first fruits, and shoot, if I can give 30%, I'll give 30%. He won't do it. Why? Particularly, as I was just explaining to you, you start having a family, and you get older, and life gets busier, and more obligations come your way. If this isn't a priority, it will not happen. I'm just telling you, and I know you know this is true, it will not happen. If your giving is the last check you write in the month, it will be the smallest check you write in the month. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that you plant a seed and God will, you know, you've heard those televangelists talking about that. All I'm saying is this. If you aren't serious about the budgetary decision-making process of your giving will not honor the Lord. Plain and simple. And for the believer in America, this is true. Your lifestyle will be limited by your desire to honor Christ. Okay? So quit looking at your neighbor. And when I say things like that, I'm not talking to you, although I may be. But I'm just understanding, as you're in ministry, Dan, we haven't even talked about this, but as you're starting in ministry, whether you're pastoring or starting a church, I tackle finances. It's one of the first things I tackle. You get people's heart right on finances, and you got a lot of progress. You deal with this last, and you got problems for a long time to come. Okay. Just some practical things. I've talked to a lot of people. I've talked to my dad. I've talked to the elders at our church. You understand, those of you that are in ministry, and a lot of people don't understand this concept. They don't understand this concept of giving on a regular basis. I think at minimum, you need to be giving to the Lord when you're getting your paycheck. Ideally, I think it's great to give every week because the church works on a weekly budget, right? I mean, they got obligations. If you're in ministry, you know. I mean, you got daily things that you need. The church needs the cash flow. And so I think it makes sense to sit down and write out your checks. You know, at our church, we get these envelopes that we send out to all of the members. So you get your envelope for each week. And I tell people, listen, if it helps you, sit down at the beginning of the month and write out every check, put it in the envelope, and just keep it right there. So each week, you've got it ready to go. And for most people, because if you're on a fixed income, it's practical. Then it's gone. You know, if you're using software, which is great this way, once you write that check, your ledger says it's not there. Okay? So I think this is a practical way to give honor to those whose honor is due. In other words, if you're trying to respect the elders and the pastor of your church, then giving on a regular weekly basis is a way of showing respect to them so that your giving isn't based on my terms. Okay? I don't need to go through all this stuff, but I wanted to give this to you so as you're in ministry and as you're talking to people, these are some good practical things. Most people don't understand this. They haven't even thought through the fact that the church has business responsibilities on a weekly basis. So they're given once every 2 months. And then, you know, let's just be honest here. If you're not given every week, you get like 2 months behind and you're looking at you and you're going, man, this is a lot of money, right? So what happens? Well, we're just going to discount it a little bit because I got some things going on this month. I'm telling you, if you're not doing it on a regular basis, you're not honoring the Lord because that check gets bigger and bigger and bigger every week you're not given. Okay? And then all of a sudden your flesh is talking to you and you got a little guy going, well, that's a lot of money. They don't need all that money. You need that money more than they need that money. So, okay? I put this here, local church priority, not singularly. I don't know how you feel about this, and I've not been able to find anything in Scripture that talks about it, but I think on a practical basis, when I'm developing in my own heart my desire on what I want to give to the Lord for the year, that's to the local body, to my body of believers in support of their ministry to me and my family. What I choose to give to Southern Seminary or what I choose to give to OM missions or what I choose to give to missionaries is out of my own personal cash flow. It's not out of the Lord's money. Does that make sense? Okay. I get asked a lot, you know, my church is doing well. Their budget looks good. I'm going to start siphoning off some of my offering because I want to support my buddy who's going to the mission field. Nuh-uh. Okay. That's not the way I think it's designed to be. We're called to support our local body of believers because there are all kinds of needs in that body. And then our desire is to sacrificially give in ways that we can support other ministries. Okay? Let's talk a little bit about debt. Is there good debt and bad debt? It's kind of a trick question. Okay? Good debt's an oxymoron. I like those oxymorons. But a couple of things about debt. And this has more to do with just the function of our economic culture. You know, America is unique in that the vast majority, if not almost all people, buy homes on debt. There are certain cultures where you basically pay 100% cash to purchase a home. So obviously the matrix is different. In our culture, in the way things have worked out, the fact of the matter is not most people can't buy a house for cash. Okay, so getting a mortgage is a foregone conclusion. Now, what may come into play in this conversation is should I rent or buy, or is there anything fundamentally wrong with buying if I have to borrow money? I don't think there is, and the reason I don't is because this is a normal process in our culture. Getting a mortgage is a normal process, and the systems are in place to do that. A couple of things. When I did this presentation originally and I put this together, this was when the housing market was going nuts. I was telling people at break. Anybody here from like Florida or Southern California? Some of you? Okay. Where are you guys? Where is everybody else from? You said Arkansas? Okay. But you guys got, Naples, they got expensive houses down there.
West Palm Beach.
West Palm, so you know what expensive is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. It's bad now, but it'll get crazy again. Where are you from? Yeah, Canada is expensive. What part of Canada? Western? Okay. Houses are expensive. Not only are houses expensive to buy, but houses are expensive to maintain. And I like to help people understand this. Historically, houses were three times your income. That's why banks let you borrow one third of your gross income. That's pretty simple matrix. Okay, we got all out of whack. I was showing you a thing a second ago. When we had housing in our market, I live in a very normal, everyday commuter neighborhood, and houses were selling for $400, $500 a square foot. Okay? It's crazy. I mean, where I live, you can have a 2,500 square foot house on a 4,000 square foot lot. Okay? If you're not from the West Coast, you think you got to be out of your mind. But there's a lot of people out of their mind out there. So, the reason I point this out to people is this axiom in our economic culture is not changing. Unless they change laws, it's not changing. If you can't buy a house and spend less than 38% of your gross income to own that house, don't buy the house. I don't care what they tell you. Right? Never met a realtor that didn't tell you that housing prices are going to go up, right? So I'm just telling you, unless you want your life to be burdened and frustrated, do not buy a house if you got to spend. And I'm talking 38 is on the very upper end. Okay? Now, on top of that, a lot of people don't understand. Whatever your monthly payment is, you're going to be paying about 10% of that payment in ongoing maintenance on a monthly basis. So if your payment's $1,500, your utilities and maintenance is going to be about $150 to $200 every month. And they don't tell you that. So when you buy a house and you're spending $2,000, you're talking about $200 to $250 a month on top of your payment to pay for your utilities. So you need to understand that. Houses are expensive. And they're expensive to maintain. And a lot of people don't understand. They figure, well, we can cut back here and cut back here. But I go back to my first graph. Most people's income is not going to substantially change. So be very careful of this. Yeah. 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 Not for the year. That'd be an expensive house. But yeah, monthly. So let's go back to our analogy. If you're making 50, okay, and you're making approximately $1,800 a month every 2 weeks, right? Approximately. So you're talking, what, $3,600 a month? Is that about right? So three times that. No, not $3,600 a month. Yeah, about 4,000 a month. So right around 1,200, 1,500 a month. So, yeah.
My question is in rare instances, say if you got an inheritance and then you wanted to buy a house and you had the cash.
Uh-huh.
I've heard some people argue to go ahead and buy it outright. Some others say no, borrow.
Oh, so you're saying if I have the ability to buy cash, having a mortgage is better.
Yeah, that's what some are.
And they tell you that. Who told you that? The mortgage guy?
It was a friend of mine.
Okay, let me just give you two anecdotal things about that. And not knowing that, recognizing that every situation is different. Okay? If it's a second house, then you have to have in your mind the contingencies of recognition that if you're burning up all of your cash to buy it, how are you going to maintain it? For one. Okay, so if it's the first house. Okay, a couple of things that you want to consider when you're talking about that concept. One is when it comes to should I have a mortgage or not? It never, ever, ever makes sense to spend a dollar to save 50 cents. And that's the concept behind that. I've heard people say, like I had a real estate agent tell me one time, well, you know, Mark, about every 5 or 6 years, I got to buy a bigger and more expensive house so I can get their tax write-off. I'm like, what? What a stupid statement. Why would you spend a dollar to save 50 cents? Right? So I think that. Secondarily, I would tell you this. In our business, okay, we deal with a wide variety of people, but we have some extremely wealthy people that we work with to help them basically manage their portfolio. By far, the most common denominator amongst our wealthiest clients, no mortgage. By far. Which is counterculture, because all the books you read and all the guys on late night TV are telling you to buy a rental property and then leverage that one to buy another one, and all of a sudden you're leveraged up to your eyeballs, and guess what happens when the market goes bad? Right? You're living in a tent. So, by far, the most common denominator amongst extremely wealthy, successful people that I know, no mortgage. And if there's anybody that could afford a mortgage, it's these guys. So, that's that. Keep in mind, too, well, goes into some taxes, but keep in mind that you can lose your deductions pretty fast federally. So for them, having a mortgage may or may not make sense because they may not get to write off the deduction. But by and large, no mortgage is better than mortgage. So housing 30 to 38% of gross income on a monthly basis. So your monthly payment is going to be roughly 30 35% of your gross income. Utilities and maintenance. Consumer credit, we talked about this already. Credit cards. Now, I put this here because this is a little sneaky little thing that credit cards companies don't like you to do. But if you can get in the habit, let's say you happen to get in a situation where you've got a revolving balance on a credit card, send them a check every 2 weeks. That's illegal.
They're doing that.
Call your credit consumer or your Better Business Bureau. That's illegal.
But I'm saying Sears has done it. Sears has done it.
You'll pay the full amount.
Yeah, we still pay the full amount. But they're changing the due dates now a lot.
Oh, yeah, right.
They're changing the due dates, and if you pay a little early or like a week early, they don't credit it in that time period. And they're also, because they're coming up, they're putting up late fees.
Yeah.
$35 to $40.
They changed the due date.
Yeah. But I had a specific date that I would pay
everything.
Sure. Then I looked at the bill and it's late. What do you mean it's late? Like, call me and say, oh, you pay the date a day before the closing for that cycle.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, you want to double check. You may want to change credit card companies, but you want to double check with them. But what she's saying happened was, is she sent in a payment, and so it was credited for the prior month, so that the following month looked like they paid zero. Okay, I'd have a nice conversation with them on the phone if I was you. But yeah, then I'd definitely change credit card companies or change phone companies because you're on the phone too much. But bi-monthly payment on a credit card is helpful because they charge you a lot of interest. A lot of interest. Which, by the way, this was actually in court this week with the federal government. Has anybody looked at, does anybody have a savings account? Anybody looked at what you're earning? You can't see it. That's why it's so small. But boy, they sure will charge you, you know, like crazy with your credit card, but they won't pay you diddly on your savings account, which we'll talk about that in a second with investing. But anyways, that's why it's very helpful if you can. You know, say you've got a revolving credit. You use that, you had an emergency, right? Your air conditioner went on your car and you had to pay $1,200. And so you've got this thing. If you could just send in as much as you can, what happens is it goes right into your account. And it, because every single day they actually accrue your interest on a daily basis. It's not a monthly basis, it's daily. And they can't wait to charge it. Yeah. Mortgages are a little bit different. You can do that, but you on a mortgage, some of what they said, you have to make sure you contact them and you're allowed to do that. There are some mortgages that will actually penalize you for doing that. So so there's two ways to do that. The thought being on mortgages, he's talking about if you have a mortgage payment, is pay it every 2 weeks instead of once a month. The other thought people will do is they'll save up and they'll make one extra payment at the end of the year. What it does is over a course of a 30-year period compounding, you can save, depending on the size of your mortgage, tens if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, I mean, for the most part, on a mortgage, you're going to pay anywhere between 50 and 100% more than you borrowed for the life of that mortgage. Okay? So that's a great point on the mortgage. Just make sure that when you're applying for your mortgage or you're deciding to try and do that, which you're right is a great idea, make sure you contact your mortgage company and make sure that either A, they're aware you're going to do it, or B, ask them, can I do this? And if I do, will it be credited to my principal? Because that's what you want. Okay? Now, but keep in mind this, and this is the thing that's a little bit goofy about compounding and mortgages. If you are making extra payments and you want to make it going to your principal, so let's say you make two payments and you want to put as much of that to the principal as possible, that will not change your future payments. It will merely shorten the amount of time it takes you to pay it off. Does that make sense? I've had people come to me and they'll say, hey, I got an inheritance for $10,000. We want to pay down our mortgage so that we can reduce our payment. It won't reduce your payment. It'll just mean that your 30-year mortgage becomes a 27-year mortgage or 28-year mortgage. So just understand that. That by paying down principal, you're actually not changing the amount you owe on a monthly basis. Whereas on a credit card, you are, but on a mortgage, you're not.
Does it work the same paying off student loans?
You know, I don't know the answer to that on student loans. As a general rule, this is what you want to do. But I think secondarily on that is just call them and ask them if you can do that. If you can do it, absolutely do it, because it does make a significant difference, especially on a mortgage, because of the size of the loan typically and the length of the loan. You can shorten a mortgage. I think I've seen, depending on the size of the mortgage, you can shorten your loan anywhere from 3 to 8 years by just making one extra payment a year. It's pretty significant. Yeah. Yeah. When it comes to refinancing, you need to make sure you've got a very, very credible and trustworthy person, because there's all kinds of ways that they can schnooker you. You can make a lot of money in that business by being... Yeah. You also want to be careful. We've seen this a lot in the last 4 or 5 years, although... The good news, not the good news, but the unfortunate thing is interest rates aren't going much lower. So if you refinanced, the Fed is at zero. So the rates are going to probably be going up over time from here. But not yet. I'll address that. But when it comes to, I forgot what I was going to say. It'll come to me. So consolidate where possible when it comes to consumer credit. That's just simply saying that if you've got multiple payments going in multiple directions, it's just harder. It's just harder to manage that. So, if it's possible to consolidate. Oh, I know what I was going to say. I've seen a lot of people recently refinancing, and if you're not careful, you'll get these people. I had a friend that was in this situation where their mortgage broker was convincing them that they should refinance every 6 months, something crazy like that. Don't do that. I mean, unfortunately, in our culture, L.A. is terrible at this. Nobody in Los Angeles tries to actually own anything. They just try to cash flow everything. It's actually good to own something. Pay it off. Actually own it. Okay? Otherwise, you're just renting it. So the point is, I've seen a lot of people that they'll get 5, 6, 7 years into a 30-year mortgage, refinance into another 30-year mortgage. Okay? So you need to take all those things into account in terms of how you're deciding to do those things. Luxury and personal items, referring to specifically to debt, I think the general rule of thumb is if you're going to buy something that's what I call a luxury item or an optional item, you need to pay cash. You need to pay cash. I don't think it makes sense to buy a boat on credit. I don't think it makes sense to buy a motor scooter or a toy or whatever the case might be. Quite frankly, I don't think it makes sense to go on vacation on credit, because the misery of paying off your credit card is worse than the joy of being there for 2 days. So, luxury or optional items are things that you need to build into your budget, save up the cash, and pay cash for them. I don't care if you buy a boat. Just don't buy it with a monthly payment. That doesn't make any sense. Okay? We'll talk in a minute about why I think that's important. But using up 100% of your cash on a monthly basis is a terribly irresponsible thing to do. It leaves you no room to bear one another's burden. Okay? And I see this a lot. Is people live comfortably, but they're using every dime they make, and they have no ability to serve, support, and encourage one another when any opportunity for ministry comes along. It's a massive mistake, and you've just robbed yourself of the opportunity to have immense joy. There really is no, there's very few earthly joys greater, other than your own family, than to be able to help and support somebody in need, particularly in finances. Okay? So just be aware of that. Okay, let's keep going here. Let's talk a little bit about insurance. Property and casualty. Pretty straightforward stuff. You need to have auto insurance. The only other thing that I would talk about when it comes to property and casualty as it pertains to auto insurance is just understand the relationship between deductible and your premium. Meaning this, you need to get comfortable with the deductible amount. The higher your deductible, the exponentially smaller your premium becomes. And that's called hazard risk. Let me explain that to you. When an insurance company comes and says, okay, you've got a car. Okay, you've got a 2005 Ford F-150. Okay? And they say, okay, it's going to cost you $1,000 a year to insure that for a $500 deductible. You guys all know what a deductible is, right? It's the money that you got to pay out of pocket if something happens. So you've got a $500 deductible and $1,000 premium. All you need to do is ask them, if I make my deductible $1,000, what will my premium be? It will be a lot less than $1,000. And the reason why is because the higher your deductible, the less likely you are to run around and ding them for every little thing that happens to your car. Does that make sense? So it's called hazard, moral hazard in insurance business, which means that the more apt you are to make a claim, the more they're going to make sure they don't lose any money. Insurance companies don't lose money. You understand that, right? They do not lose money. They are extremely good at pricing things to the point where they do not lose money. So the less likely you are to make them pay for something, the cheaper it becomes to you. So I'm a big proponent that, let's say you get a new car and you're doing your budget. Build into your budget. And let's just say that you know for whatever reason, you're like, man, if something happened, if we got hit with a car or if we crashed our truck and it cost me $1,000 to fix it, I couldn't fix it and I'd be out of a truck. Well, then don't do that. But try to build into your budget $100 a month. Build into that budget so that in the second year, you can go to them and say, I want to reduce my or increase my deductible and thereby reduce my premium. Over time, a higher deductible will always save you money. Does that make sense? So it may not be possible right away. Yeah, question. It may not be possible right away. I understand that. But you got to have some foresight in thinking, okay, it would really stink if I had to be out of pocket $1,500 if I get in a car accident. That being said, the premium savings on changing a deductible from $500 to $1,500 would be incredibly high. I mean, we're talking maybe $800 a year. I mean, it might almost be commensurate with the increase of deductible. So in the first year of insurance, if you can build into your budget kind of a savings, if you will, and put that money into your savings account, raise your deductible, you will basically, in essence, beat the system. Does that make sense? So, and this is true with most all insurance. Yeah.
And also, we have to watch what we're carrying as far as our limits, too, because if you carry minimum insurance, you're not covered in an accident.
Right. I'm going to explain that. I'm going to get to amounts in a second. 50, 250, or 500, 200.
So if you've got a good driving record, I mean, do you recommend deductible being $1,000?
Yes.
Really? Okay. Any higher than that?
If they'll let you.
Really? Okay.
Oh,
that's great.
But
sometimes you go higher than
that. Yeah. I think it depends on you and your record, but you could go as high as $2,000, I think, on a car. Right, that's only for you. Yeah, that's only for you. Yeah, if you've got a good driving record, and I got an old truck that I like driving. My wife doesn't like it because it's really an old truck, but I like driving it. I'm a guy. My deductible is it isn't even worth $2,000, so my deductible is $2,000. It's if I crash it, well, I'll just throw it away. I mean, why spend the money on the insurance? So, you got to take into account some people insure. They got their money. Their car is insured for more than the car is worth. So you always have to carry liability, but it's illegal to not have liability. You understand the difference between liability and the other? Liability is what you do to somebody else, and paying for their vehicle. And he makes a good point. Let me skip ahead. We're going kind of slow here. Let's talk about home. Home insurance. I put catastrophic events because depending on where you live, you need to make sure that certain catastrophic events are covered. Like in California, if you don't specifically ask for it, you don't get earthquake insurance. So you're insured, but if we have an earthquake, well, we don't cover that. Or like the zip code that I live in, we're not automatically covered for fire because we live in a high fire area. Okay? So if you're in the South, then you may not be covered for hurricanes. And they won't tell you that unless you ask them. So make sure you ask them, what's my catastrophic hazard coverage? Yeah.
A lot of firms do tell people that they have the hurricane insurance. What if they don't? I mean, a lot of the times we've had people say, oh, you need to get this because they'll recommend us to the people who do the coverage, and sometimes it's including basic insurance.
Yeah. What you need to do is you need to double check, and if you're not sure, you need to call your state insurance commissioner, which, and I know it sounds like a lot, but you can go online and just email them. Just email them and say, what are the requirements for homeowners insurance in my state? I'm not sure if my carrier actually covers this. Otherwise, you got to read the whole binder on information, which you probably aren't going to do. So, I put on here personal effects riders. Keep in mind that most homeowners insurance isn't going to cover personal effects. Ladies, jewelry and stuff like that is usually not covered in your homeowners insurance. So, just make sure that you know exactly what's covered. Okay. Having said that, these are expensive. But just know that you aren't covered for everything. You know, if you flush your diamond ring down the toilet, they're not going to reimburse you. Okay? So just make sure you understand what key items are available. This is purely anecdotal. I'm in the process of trying to acquire one. That's why I think it makes a lot of sense. To have one of those little personal safes. And you can get them at Walmart for $50 to $100 just to keep your personal effects, depending on where you are, because that keeps it safe in case of fire, theft, all those things. So it's a very, very good cost-effective way to do that. I'm gonna respond to your questions that you comment you said earlier about coverages on auto. And the reason I bring this up, this came up with me recently, is an umbrella policy. Who knows what an umbrella policy is? I live in a litigious state, so I know exactly what it is.
Sworn for you, have an overriding liability.
Right.
Policy that covers home and auto.
Right. An umbrella policy basically is a policy that acts as an umbrella over all of your assets, but doesn't kick in until all your other insurance is already paid. So let me give an example, because you were asking about coverage on a car. On a car, they're gonna give you they're gonna bamboozle you with numbers, and you're gonna be like, sure. So they're gonna say, well, that's 100, 250, 50. And what that means is your coverage is this, coverage for everybody else is this, and medical is this, okay? What happens with an umbrella policy is an umbrella policy will step in the case of a massive accident, and all of your limits are maxed out. Now, typically with most insurance carriers, an umbrella policy will force you to have a 250-500 on your auto. Now, 250-500 means that you are covered for $250,000 of damage and medical, and the person that you hit is covered for $500. Does that make sense? Let's say, you know, heaven forbid, you get in an accident and you hit a van full of people, and you've got like 8 people in the hospital. And your insurance company is going to have to pay for that, right? It's completely your fault. Well, your insurance company goes, hey, we've only got to pay $500,000. That's where this kicks in. Everything from 500, typically up to 1 million. So most umbrella policies are $1 million policies, but they don't kick in until the maximum amount of insurance has been paid on other policies. Same thing is true with homeowners. Somebody's walking, I don't know if you guys have this out here, but like I said, we live in California where there's a lot of wackos, and somebody's driving, walking down the street, and they trip over a tree root in your yard, and they fall and break their neck, and they become a quadriplegic, and they sue you. Okay? Your homeowner's insurance is going to pay up to $200,000. Your umbrella is going to pay everything above that. Does that make sense? When I lived in Illinois, we had a trampoline. Trampolines are big in Illinois. Are they big out here? Yeah. Our insurance carrier at first said, well, if you're going to have a trampoline, you got to have a $2 million umbrella policy, because if your neighbor's kid, because we didn't have fences in our neighborhood, if your neighbor, while you're out of town, walks onto your property and goes bouncing on your trampoline and falls and breaks his neck, his parents can sue you. Well, your first response is, get out of my yard! But unfortunately, that's the society that we live in. So they said, you got to get an umbrella policy. Then the next year they came back and they said, you got to put one of them fences around, you know, your trampoline. And the next year they said, you got to get rid of it. So anyways, that's an umbrella policy. I would venture to guess most none of you have this currently because of your situation, but these are very cheap. I just bought one recently, $240 for the year was my premium. So, and it's well worth it in my view. So it's very cheap, depending on where you are too. I mean, that's in Los Angeles. It's very cheap insurance, and it's good insurance. It makes a tremendous amount of sense. Okay, healthcare. Health insurance. All I wanted to really share with you on health insurance is the same concept is true with auto. Is managing your deductible relative to your premiums is very important. Managing your deductible relative to your premium. I highly recommend that if you've got children, you find a very trustworthy and reputable health insurance guy. And have him help you design a plan that includes an HSA. You know what an HSA is? A healthcare savings account. It was a law that was passed in the last few years by the government. Basically, the government allows you to have your own deductible savings account for healthcare. So you can put what's called pre-tax dollars. So you can put money into a savings account. Some of you, if you've worked at a company, you might have had a healthcare account, but it was one of those things where it was use it or lose it. Anybody ever have one of those at a company where you had to kind of guess how much you'd use? And So you'd put pre-tax dollars into this thing, and then at the end of the year, you'd be like, go get some glasses, honey. We got to spend this money. So the government came out and said, well, that's ridiculous. So they created this HSA, which is a healthcare savings account, which allows you to put pre-tax money into an account that can then be used specifically for healthcare. It can be used for bills that are going towards your deductible. So depending on your income, you're talking about a 20 to 35% savings by doing this. So for instance, in my situation with four kids, and my partner's in the same thing, what we've done is we've raised our deductible and we've increased the amount of money that we put into the HSA. So if our deductible, I think our deductible is like $3,000 per individual, $5,000 for the family. Okay, health insurance is very expensive on your own if you're a business owner. Okay, we have a high deductible, and then what we do is each month we put money into an HSA. If you go to the doctor, you have them send the bill to the insurance company. Okay, depending on the insurance, if you're on an HMO, this doesn't necessarily pertain to you, but for those of you that are going to be in churches almost always have either an HMO or they're going to have a high deductible plan, just because it's the cheaper one. Okay, if they do that, make sure you get an HSA. Does that make sense? Okay, if you don't understand that, you can come and ask us afterwards. But suffice it to say this: find somebody that'll help you develop a good plan. This is a good way to save money, and not have to spend unused money. Yeah.
Holler for them.
Oh, you mean like a healthcare person?
Yeah.
Well, that's a really good question. Because even though we sell insurance, I'm always leery of insurance salesmen, you know. They always say if you're traveling on a plane, the two worst people to be sitting next to is a Jehovah's Witness and an insurance salesman. But you know, I think I'd probably start with trying to identify a reputable insurance broker versus an agent. And I know I'm getting a little bit technical there. In the industry, an agent works for a specific company. So he's a MetLife guy, or he's an Allstate guy, or he's a State Farm guy. My personal view on healthcare, not on property and casualty, on healthcare is you want somebody that will help steer you to the best health insurance for your situation. Because unlike property and casualty, which is just purely actuarial information, healthcare is very unique and customized to your situation, you know, if you're diabetic and all the different variables. So, ideally, you want to try to find a broker. Yeah.
I think maybe Guidestone would probably be very helpful because
of this. Oh, a Guidestone.
Yeah,
Guidestone might help you. Might help steer you to that. Yeah, but I think it's very localized. It's not like I can give you a national guy that says, you know, we've got a guy that is in our area that goes to our church and he's just really, really good at it. And so it wasn't hard for me. But I mean, that doesn't help you. I guess I'm saying ideally you want to try to find a broker versus an agent. Yeah. And you may want to call Guidestone and they might be able to help you in that area. Okay. Let's hustle through this. Life insurance. We talked a little bit about that. But why do we have life insurance? And to what degree? I'm a big believer in life insurance, not just because we don't do much of it, but because I think it's a prudent and wise thing to do, given our economic culture. The primary purpose for life insurance is income replacement. I am by de facto saying, life insurance is not an investment. So when somebody comes to your house and tells you this is a great investment, be careful. Life insurance is not an investment. It can be a good savings vehicle, but that's not its primary purpose. You're buying protection. Good salespeople will always address your greed and not your need. Okay? I shouldn't say good. Guys that make a lot of money will always address your greed and not your need. Okay? But the primary purpose of life insurance is income replacement. I always say it's not healthy for a marriage to have a husband worth more dead than he is alive. So, but you want to replace income. The goal, primarily with insurance, at its most basic concept, is to protect your family and loved ones. And when I say protect, I'll show you in a second. Let me help you understand a little bit about the differences between temporary versus permanent insurance. This is an ongoing debate that's been around since the invention of the wheel, I think. But temporary insurance is what is commonly known as term insurance. Okay, permanent insurance is what is commonly known as whole life or variable life insurance. Let me just explain to you as best I can. Temporary insurance is just that. It's temporary. It has a fixed term at which it is no longer going to pay a benefit. Okay? Temporary insurance is issued based on two things, your age and how long you want to own it. So if somebody says, I want a level 20-year, what that means is I'm going to buy an insurance policy that for 20 years I will pay the same premium every year. At the end of 20 years, it's gone. I don't have it. Now, they're going to tell you it's guaranteed renewable. That may be true, but your premium will be a lot higher when that happens. Okay? You have to understand the most profitable insurance product in the entire insurance business is term. Because they will statistically figure out exactly when you're going to die, and they'll make it stop right before you do. Okay? I mean, I say that like it's a negative. Having said that, it's probably the best insurance for most people because it's the most cost-effective. See, the insurance company doesn't insure people based on an individual. They insure you based on a group. What's your age? What's your health history? Where do you live? And then they're going to put you into a pool. They pool their risk. So the benefits to this is term insurance is very cost effective. It's very cheap. Term insurance is very cheap, assuming that the end of the insurance ends before you get into the window and when you're most likely going to die. Does that make sense? Okay? It's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. It allows you to get maximum coverage for minimal amounts of dollars. And the reason why that's important as a family is because it allows me to have maximum amounts of life insurance coverage in a period in which I have the greatest risk at the least amount of money. Okay? That being said, though, is it will end before you're most likely going to use it. I said that it's the most profitable kind of insurance there is, because 95% of term life insurance, 99% of term insurance policies are never paid out, which isn't bad. That's why they're cheap. Because they're not going to have to pay them. Okay? But again, you're buying protection. And I'm talking really cheap on a relative basis. I mean, in terms of what you can get for the dollar, you can get $1 million life insurance policy for cheap, a couple hundred bucks a year. So, depending on your age. So, temporary is a policy that is going to cover you in the case of death for a specific amount of time. We always recommend that you buy level term. Level term. Okay? That's my next slide that talks about it. I'll wait a second to explain how you want to do that. But basically what you want to do, the general rule of thumb, particularly if you've got kids, is you don't want your term to end. This is my personal philosophy. I don't want my term to end until my youngest child has graduated from college or about that age. Okay? So whatever my youngest child is, the age at which they're 23, whatever that time period is, that's the amount of term insurance, because that's the greatest risk. When my wife, I don't want her to have to work when the greatest amount of needs are college. In other words, once your last kid is out of college, typically your lifestyle costs begin to decline. Okay? So you want to buy a term policy that is going to end about that period. Typically that's 20 to 30 years. Okay? Now, what is permanent insurance? Permanent insurance is insurance that is just that. It's permanent. It's substantially more expensive. I mean, a lot more expensive. But that being said, it never goes away. As long as you keep paying your premium, you always have it. So no matter what happens to you, no what illnesses you get, once you have that insurance, it's permanent. And so long as they're contractually obligated to pay out a benefit once they've signed that contract. Yeah. An age limit? Yeah, I mean, they'll only pay up to 99.
Like if you're 95.
Yeah.
You know, they might cut it at 90.
Yeah, you want to make sure that when you're buying it, we always talk to people, if you're going to buy a permanent policy, you want to make it to 100. I mean, you don't want to pay insurance premiums till you're 98, lose your insurance, and die the next year. Because you're going to have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars if you're doing that. Most young people aren't buying permanent insurance because it's just expensive. Okay? That being said, once you get into the window of likelihood to die, it's kind of a morbid thought, but once you kind of get into your window of actuarial death, permanent insurance is usually a much better way to go. Because even though it's expensive, because it's permanent, term insurance, once you get into your 60s and 70s, is very expensive. It's very, very expensive. And permanent gives you cash value, and I'm not going to get into all the details, but this. Let me just say this parenthetically. I said it when I talked about it up here. Don't treat your insurance as an investment. Variable life, variables have variables. And you don't want to give your family variables. Okay? There's a lot of people that have these great variable policies that when they got them, the hypothetical said, man, if you do this, whew, I mean, you'll have more money than you know what to do with. Oh, unless the market goes down 40%, which hardly ever happens. Ah, I'm sorry, it happened. Okay? So, just insurance is insurance. It's not an investment. You're buying protection for specific needs, so you're getting specific coverage. Be specific. And then life insurance is a great tool for estate planning. So as you're counseling people in your church, or maybe you have an inheritance, or maybe you're worth this, if your total net worth is in excess of $3 million, you're going to have to pay a lot of tax to the government. About 40% of every dollar above $3 million is going to get taxed just because you just made too much money. So life insurance is a great way to leverage yourself to be able to pay that. And then for disability planning. Okay? I said I'd go over this. I already talked about most of this. There's just some things to think about as you're developing how much life insurance should I buy. I want to protect my family. I want to have enough coverage till my youngest child is out of college to provide for my family's needs. I want to be able to provide enough insurance so that there's appropriate time to be with my family after death, meaning I don't want... If I were to die, it's primarily the primary wage earner, but if I were to die, I don't want my wife to have to run out and get a job. Okay? It allows my spouse to be focused on the family and ministry rather than trying to figure out how we're going to make ends meet. It provides for living arrangement continuity. Parenthetically, when you get a mortgage and they tell you to buy mortgage insurance, that's just another form of life insurance. Don't do it. Okay? Don't do it. If you've got a good insurance policy, you don't need mortgage insurance. That's exactly what it is. If you die, your life insurance should give you. And then that's another question that's circumstantial, is if a spouse does die and they get a life insurance payout, should they pay off the mortgage or keep paying it? That's where you need to consult an advisor. It depends on your tax bracket. Okay, it's going to depend on your tax bracket and whether or not the write-off is worth it. Because at that point, you may have such a reduced income that you're not getting the tax benefit because you don't have any W-2 income anymore. Okay. This is one that I think is really important, is as believers, obviously we know that the local church has a responsibility to provide for widows, right? If I have the means to buy a life insurance policy that prevents my elders from having to provide for my wife, then I need to be a good steward and do it. I shouldn't burden my body of believers to be supporting my wife, although it's biblical, simply because I was too lazy, too selfish, or too irresponsible to buy life insurance. Does that make sense? So although I'm a huge believer that we as a church body need to be providing for widows and orphans, it shouldn't be because the husband was a knucklehead or the wife was a ding-a-ling and didn't get life insurance. Okay? And if they are, we'll still do it. But you understand my point. We spend money on such frivolous things that if we just took a kingdom view, we could be freeing up money for people that have needs rather than our selfishness and, frankly, our materialism. Okay. Oh, good question. Right. Great question, Dan. Should I carry life insurance on both? The good news is, ladies are much cheaper, okay, in that aspect of life. So, should I carry? I think it's practical to carry insurance on your wife for a couple of reasons. One is you're going to have some transitional needs, either for child care or whatever the case might be. So I think it does make sense to have a relatively smaller, obviously, you know, smaller insurance policy, whether it's $100,000. I mean, that sounds like a lot of money, but you got to understand, you could get a $100,000, $200,000 policy for like $10 a month. I mean, it's extremely cheap. But I do think it's a good choice to try to insure your spouse in the untimely event of death, so that you've got coverage for basic child care or funeral arrangements or whatever the case might be. Is that what you're kind of referring to, Dan? Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it makes sense to have as much coverage on your wife as you do on you, so that if she dies, you can stop working. Okay. I that has moral hazard, but I don't think that's not the wise thing to do. I just think you need to have some transitional needs met for that. That comes with another question, because you get this a lot from Gerber when you have a baby, right? You get all the things in the mail. Don't you want to buy life insurance for your kid? Your kid doesn't need life insurance. They don't generate any income. Okay, so that's a scam, I think, buying life insurance on a kid. It doesn't make any sense at all to me. Okay, I just don't think it's necessary. I think it's a waste of money. Good question or good comment, Dan. Okay, how are we doing on time? All right, let's just kind of get through this, and then we'll take a break, go grab some lunch, and then we'll come back and answer some questions. Is this stuff helpful? Am I going too fast? I know we're covering a lot of stuff. Investing in markets now. The reality is in our practice, this is most of what we do. We're money managers, and so most of our time is spent managing investment portfolios. So I don't want to get too into the nitty-gritty of our personal philosophy on the situation with investing in the markets and, you know, what are the markets going to do? Is the Dow Jones going to go up or down? And what do I think of Wall Street and all those things? Because I have a lot of opinions on that. But the basic axiom is this when it comes to investing. If it's too good to be true, it is. Okay? There's nothing new under the sun. I am continually amazed at people's willingness to make easy money. It's amazing. And unfortunately, the church is a huge target for this. Amongst its own people. Okay? This is totally practical, and I didn't even have this in my notes, but just understand this. You need to make sure that most people understand you are not allowed. You are not allowed to use the church membership role as your mailing list. Amen. That is totally inappropriate. Happens all the time, and it is completely inappropriate. Do not allow, as leadership, do not allow people to see your church body as their greatest money-making opportunity. And I'm serious about this. This is a massive way to create massive division, heartache, and frustration in the body. It's a huge no-no in my view. I'm not saying you can't do business with people in your church, for crying out loud. That's who you want to do business with. I mean, if you trust them. But it's the ones that come in and see this as their networking opportunity. Massive no-no to me. And completely unprofessional. And nobody who's good at what they do is doing that. Okay, I'm off my soapbox. Okay. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. Okay? It's not easy to make money. It's just not. They say it's easy. It ain't easy. If it was easy, they'd be doing it. and not telling you about it. I said that earlier. Okay? Here's a simple concept that I've taken in my own life. No risk that will negatively affect my day-to-day life if the result is capital loss, meaning substantial capital loss, is worth taking. No risk that will negatively affect my day-to-day life if the result is capital loss is worth taking. Translation: I should not be risking my money that has predetermined needs attached to it in anything other than safe investments. Okay? Risk is inherently risk. The other day I was talking to a client and we were talking about some things that he wanted to take a look at doing, and we've done some things for him, and he said, well, can we make more? Which is always a very frustrating conversation to have. Can we make more? But we just made you a lot. But can we make more? It's like a kid. It's amazing, people's view on money. Can we make more? I said, well, sure. If you want to take more risk. I don't want to take more risk. Well, then you can't make more. I mean, you'd think that would be a simple axiom, right? Taking more risk is necessary to make more money. It's kind of how capitalism works. The fact of the matter is most people continually convince themselves that they can make more without taking risk. It's just not true. And where it does happen, it's lucky. Okay? Yeah.
You can just think of it as a gamble. Some people think that I'll gamble the house or mortgage bank. Others take the view that if I'm going to gamble, I'm going to gamble with money that if I lose it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't affect your day-to-day life. I mean, I've dealt with situations recently where people took money, they took home equity out of their home to make an investment in another thing. That thing went bad, and now they're losing their home because of it. That's stupid. Even if that thing had made money, I would have said that's stupid. That is a very, very, very poor, poor decision. And that's what I'm saying here. If you take a risk, and I don't have an ethical problem with risk, I'm in the risk business. But if your risk, if wrong, substantially changes your day-to-day life, don't take it. Another way of saying it is if you can stand losing it all, do it. But don't do it otherwise. Okay? So understanding what is risk and how does that do? And in risk, to me, there's a lot of things involved in risk. And it's not always just capital, dollars. There's emotional risk. There is relationship risk. There's a lot of risk inherent in decisions that people aren't really always processing that I think they need to be considering. Interview and identify an advisor who's like-minded. That was kind of my response to your question about healthcare. As much as we have created all kinds of tools on the internet, the fact of the matter is there are people out there that are good at what they do, that are good in this area. One of the things that I think has happened as a result of the internet is while we have given people unbelievable amounts of information, we have not necessarily increased their ability to use the information. Okay? So we have completely inundated people with information that they have no ability on how to handle. It's like giving people an entire room full of surgical equipment and saying, go do surgery. I mean, it's possible they could do it. And in some very small cases, if they're taking a splinter out or something, they can. But you need to be trained to handle certain things, and only certain people legally have access to information that allows you to garner the proper information, for instance, with healthcare or whatnot. So you just make sure you identify and interview an advisor in these areas. I just thought of this. If you are in a position in your life where you decide that you want to take some risk with some money that may not necessarily change that, I still think it's very practical to make sure that you and your wife are on the same page. And if you decide that you're going to become a day trader or you're going to go online at night and you're going to trade options, just, Make sure you buy her a purse before you do that, just practically speaking, because you can get yourself really out of whack. Diversification, obviously, is a foregone conclusion on that. Be prudent and patient. When I first got in the investment business, I moved to Chicago. The Lord opened some doors for me to move back there, and it turned out to be a great opportunity for all kinds of reasons in our life. But I was in an office of an old guy in downtown Chicago, and up on the top floor, and he was an old guy. He'd been in the business for a long, long time. And I'll never forget, I asked him, I said, listen, I can't, I don't have a clue what I'm doing. I mean, I was like 23 or 24. I don't have a clue what I'm doing. I says, let me ask you the question. How do you make money for yourself and for your clients? And I'll never forget it. He leaned back and goes, slowly. That was his response. There is no quick fix, okay? And in our culture is going to do everything it can to convince you that there is quick ways to do it. But the fact of the matter is it's not quick. In fact, I'll show you here in a second. Do not use money that will possibly be needed within 1 to 3 years. If you haven't learned the severity of unplanned problems in the last 18 months, you never will. Okay? What we're going through and what we've been through and what we will continue to be in, I think, for the next foreseeable future, these difficult economic times, has rocked people. I mean, it has turned people on end. Okay? And yet, within all of that, people that didn't have money exposed to the risks that they need are just like, oh man, it's a bummer. But it didn't necessarily change what they're doing. Okay? I can't tell you. I know two or three people that had a wife answer the door and had a sheriff standing there because they were getting evicted. And she had no clue. These are guys that were successful. One guy was a doctor, making very, very good income. But they had basically put nothing away, had been using everything they could. They lost it in the stock market. Their business went down, and now they're losing their house, and they're literally living in a hotel. And he's a doctor. So don't think that your income can save bad decision-making, because it can't. It just basically creates them on a compounded basis. And then I just put this on here, the rule of 72, if you're ever kind of curious to see how things work. If you divide whatever interest rate you're getting, this is kind of depressing for those of you that said that you're getting 0.2% on your savings rate. You can do the math. But if you divide whatever interest rate you're getting into 72, that'll tell you the number of years it's going to take you to double your money. It's just a simple rule. So if you're earning 7%, it's going to take you 7.2 years to double your money. It just helps you people understand that it's not easy. It's just not easy. And going back to my very, very early comments, living on a budget that uses up every last dollar, I think you're playing with fire. I really think you're playing with fire. I tell you this, there's a lot of unknowns that you don't even know about. That's like a Yogi Berra comment. There's a lot of unknowns that you don't even know about. I mean, there just are. There are so many unknowns out there that it's very, very dangerous to not presume that at some point something's going to happen that we did not see coming. Yeah?
Does that work with when you're borrowing from other people too? Like if you have a mortgage, how long will it take for me to double their income at this interest rate?
I don't know. You mean like how much money are they making off me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I guess you could. I never thought through that. I don't know. But I'll go back to my earlier comments. If you can pay down debt, do it. That's my simple axiom. I think it's so funny. These guys are like, I'm a debt manager. It's real easy. Pay it off. I mean, it's not hard. See what you're making each month. Manage it well. A mortgage is the cheapest debt you're going to have. And pay it off. Now, that's what I was saying earlier. But because of the economic culture of our society, I do not think it makes sense to accelerate my mortgage payment at the expense of creating an opportunity to meet needs financially in the body. That's just a practical word of advice from me. I think it makes sense to accelerate debt payments in other types of debt, okay? But on a mortgage, and maybe if you've got a car payment, that can make some sense, okay? Let me make one comment about car payments. Don't get a five-year, if you can help it, don't get a five-year loan on a car, because you will be at a point at which you owe way more than the car is worth. If you put $2,000, $3,000 down on a car, you can get upside down on that car, and you're stuck. You're going to be paying on a car that isn't even worth what you're paying on it. Does that make sense? You know, I see people that go out there and they kind of squeeze into this payment on a car, and next thing you know it, 4 years into it, their car is beat up, and they don't even like it anymore, and they owe $10,000 on it, and it's worth five. That's a terrible feeling, by the way. And you still got to drive it, and you got to insure it. What a pain. So I tell people, try to stay. If you can't afford a car payment, a very reasonable car payment on a three-year loan, get a cheaper car. Okay? Get a cheaper car. Ideally, pay cash. But if you can't do that, which I understand, buy used cash is, I think, the most ideal situation. But if you need to get a car and you need to make a car payment, keep it within 3 years. Okay? And if you're buying a used car, if you're buying a used car, keep it within two, because you're going to pay a higher interest rate on a car loan for a used car than you are a new car. So if you're buying a used car and you're borrowing money to do it, try to keep it within a two-year loan. Yeah?
You mentioned about debt and needs in the body. What would you say to somebody who has significant debt but is not giving back to the Lord first in order to pay off the debt?
Yeah, that's a good question. His question was, that's one of the big questions that they have is should people be paying down debt instead of giving to the Lord? Is that what you're saying, essentially? There's a lot built into that question. I don't think it makes practical. First of all, you shouldn't have been in that situation, but you are. Not you, but people, okay? That person needs to be, my first comment would be this, that person needs to be willing to succumb themselves to an incredible amount of accountability with a godly older person in their life. First and foremost, because they've got some serious decisions to work through. Secondarily, if there's no way they can afford at all to make the minimum payment on their debt and give to the Lord, that's what I'm saying. I want to know that. And I want to, if they truly desire to honor the Lord in their life, and they're really sincerely committed to that, and they've got this serious dilemma, if I'm an elder in that church, I'm saying, let me see your books. Because it may very well be they can't. Okay? And so at that point, I go back to the comment that the other body of believers is going to be supporting this in a de facto way. That's a very rare circumstance, because usually you're going to be able to negotiate some sort of a payment schedule that doesn't use up 100% of your income. Does that make sense? So it's such a rare thing, but if on a very practical, pragmatic way, as in leadership at a church, if I had a situation like that, I would ask for an incredible amount of accountability with that person until we saw them making some substantial changes in their life to make those things different. Because what I see a lot of times is people basically, they don't want to give up a lot of other ancillary things in their life. And because the church doesn't, unless you're a Mormon, the church doesn't send you a bill for your offering, you know, they do that. And they'll actually garner your wages. It's kind of an interesting concept. I think we should adopt it. But I do think that's a very rare situation. But if it happens, I would ask to have an extremely high level of accountability with them and helping them get to a point where they can get that into a manageable number. I don't think it needs to be paid off first, though. I mean, hey, they got into that. They're going to have to struggle a little bit to make it work. But unfortunately, the quick response for most people is to just not give. So, we're running out of time. Yeah.
We need to be cautious and, you know, not assuming.
Absolutely.
Could have been medical related debt.
No, and my comment was not accountability for their responsibility. I want a high level of accountability to help them work through a plan that will allow them to do both. I wasn't trying to be judgmental on them at all. What I'm saying is if they sincerely desire to honor the Lord, I don't think it's an either or. I think we want to sit down and let's develop a plan here. Is that it, Danny? It's Christian food, even.
We want to talk to you back.
Do you want to, just so they can get an idea, do they want to, why don't we plan on this? We'll come back, we'll touch on taxes very briefly, and then we can talk about the other stuff, and then we'll try to fix that Q&A in.